Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We have got a great local food focused show for you today, with the second in our series on chocolate shops. We head to Mass Ave in downtown Indianapolis to talk with chocolatier Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town, who recently marked 10 years in business on the avenue and who just expanded her shop. We'll find out what she's up to this time of year as she prepares for Valentine's Day, and we'll hear about what's new in the shop as well. Today we also talk with Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler, founder and executive director of Brandywine Creek Farms, an organization that's tackling the problem of rural food deserts and food insecurity by raising produce for local food banks. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Massachusetts Avenue in Indianapolis is undergoing considerable change right now, with new buildings going up, others being renovated, and plans being made for new ones as well. But 10 years ago, the scene was much different. The cultural trail was just a green stripe painted on the pavement, and there weren't nearly as many businesses on Mass Ave. Certainly not at the far end, where you'll find the best chocolate in town. But chocolatier Elizabeth Garber, who had been operating her chocolate business in Franklin, Indiana, saw potential in the 800 block of Massachusetts Avenue, where the highly acclaimed Our Bistro had opened in 2001. There was momentum, and she saw what the area could be. And now, 10 years later, the avenue is vibrant and growing, and so is the best chocolate in town. I stopped in recently to check out the shop's new expansion, try the coffee and cookies, and get the scoop on Valentine's Day in a chocolate shop.
We have expanded into a cafe space. We've added espresso, we've added cookies, and we're adding brownies and so other baked goods. And we have all this seating as well. So we're excited and we're expanded and we're growing.
Now, when was it? When was the grand reopening? Because I think there's a story there, right?
Right. Yeah, the grand reopening was January 20th, which is 10 years to the day that I opened on Mass Ave.
The exact day,
January 20th of 2007, I opened in this space, and then here we are 10 years later.
Oh my gosh. So tell me a little bit about, kind of describe the shop, because we're sitting in the shop on Mass Ave, surrounded by all the wonderful truffles and candies, and now cookies and coffee. Tell me about the expansion.
So we have all of our chocolate lines still, of course. And we've expanded to add a lovely espresso machine, Bee Roasters Coffee Company. They trained us, and they're supplying us with lovely espresso beans and coffee. And they've trained all of our staff really well, so we're making wonderful drinks. Then we've also expanded our line of cookies, or not expanded the line, we're creating cookies. All summer long, I worked on cookies and out of my house, and I bring them in and be like, guys, try these. What do you like? What don't you like? What should we do? And so we've got that up to date. We've got two at the moment, and then we're adding the other four flavors here in the next week or two, and other baked delicious treats. We will have croissants and muffins from Circle City Sweets. So we utilize our local folks whenever we can, and, you know, if it's something we just aren't going to be able to do, then we utilize the best person in town to do that with. So
how was the process of expanding? When were you able to fit this in? With a busy season, I mean, we just got off of Christmas, and now we're heading into Valentine's Day. When did it all happen?
Well, we've been planning it for a while, and I've kind of been, for over a year, I've been kind of taking notes, figuring out where to go. I looked at a gazillion spaces. A gazillion, that's real. That's a real number, it feels like. So, but we landed in this spot. We've got, we decided to remodel this space and then add an additional commercial kitchen, about 3,100 square feet, just 3 minutes from here in more of an industrial sort of space. Very much more traditional of make a lot of the product there. We're finishing some of it in this space and then bringing product over that we finish in the other space.
So you expanded the Mass Ave location that everyone's familiar with.
Yes, we've expanded the Mass Ave location and opened it up. We removed a wall. You'll walk in and go, something's different. Yes, we removed a wall. And so now there's seating. There are 28 seats, these lovely wooden tables. Very comfy, very cozy. A lot of people have already been coming in to sit with books or their computers and having morning meetings. And so it's working very well. Yeah, we have new hours. We're open at 8 a.m. So 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday. And 10 till 8 on Saturdays and 11 to 5 Sunday.
Wow, so that really expanded things.
Mm-hmm. It did. It did. And it feels good. It doesn't feel overstretched, which is really nice. I mean, there's always stress and stretching, but, you know, it's like it feels good and it's working really well and people are really excited, so it's nice.
Well, we have to talk about it this time of year. I mean, you must be gearing up for Valentine's Day, just coming off of Christmas. How is that in a candy shop?
Yeah. Well, it's been fun. The January move, back to the original thought of that time frame. Yes, Christmas is very intense and busy. And then we, you know, I had planned it out, and then we just stopped. Christmas Eve, we closed down and started finishing things off that needed to be done. And finishing other corporate orders, packing up things, me trying to sift through 10 years of like, why is this still piled here? And sorting some things out. And we moved on January 2nd, moved a bunch of things to the other space. And then on the 3rd, the crew came in from the 3rd to the 10th and remodeled this space. We got it painted and shifted and reconstructed a bathroom and got reopened then on the 11th of January and then had the grand opening on the 20th.
That's awesome to get remodeling done like that. I mean, I don't know what you did, but
magic. I don't know. I just ate a lot of chocolate and just kept going. I just, yeah. No, and really the owners of this particular building are Tom Batista and his son Ed, and they came in and just really, I said, this is what I'm going to need. Can you do it? And they said, yes. And I said, and by the 10th, you can do it. Yes. And I had painters, and they all worked together in harmony. It was beautiful. There were rainbows everywhere. And it happened in like 10:30 at night on the 10th. They were done. And I was like, this is crazy. So it was great.
So what was the grand reopening like? Was that fun?
It was fun. We just had, you know, free coffee and cookies, and people came in and wandered through, and it was on a Friday, and so people just kind of filtered in and out through the day. It wasn't out of control, which is good, because out of control is never good either. So, yeah, no complaints. It was great, and, you know, we're still here doing the same great stuff, so.
So what's it like here with the build-up to Valentine's Day? Does it start to get crazy?
Yeah, Valentine's is a weird beast. So the Christmas holiday, all of mid-October through December, is just intense all the time. Real busy. Valentine's, we kind of plan it. And then if you have purchased something for Valentine's Day before the 12th, at least, of Valentine's, of February, then congratulations. Because most people wait and wait and wait. And we get a little busy during that week. But truly, the 12th, 13th, and 14th are the busiest days in the shop every year, hands down.
People wait until the day of or the day before Valentine's Day?
Yeah, every year. We do get some people. I have a few orders on hand of where people have planned ahead. But for the most part, people, I don't know if it's tradition or just because people are busy. Life is busy. I don't, you know, but it tends to very much be very last minute, which is fun. We've adjusted that, and it's fun. And we have lines of people picking out truffles for their hearts. And so we have these hearts, and you can custom pick your truffles and stuff. And so it's, yeah, and it's a great thing. But, yeah, so we kind of prepare and get all the product made, like, the week or two before. And then it's just this kind of fun, insane onslaught the day before and the day of, so.
Now, does the weather affect it? You know, if the weather's bad, will people stay out, or do they still come out anyway to get their Valentine's things?
We do. I remember one year there was, like, my first year here, it was, like, truly shut down. And I was like, heck no, I'm going in. And I did, and people came. It was surprising. But, yeah, so the weather, I'm sure, obviously, it holds off some people, but we still have lines.
So you have to tell me, what are some of the perennially popular truffle flavors?
Nocturne for the real dark chocolate lovers. Chocolate chip cheesecake is always, all the cheesecake ones are popular. Strawberry cheesecake, white chocolate cheesecake. The port wine and fig is another good one. I mean, I get, it depends what, who you, you know, more so than just mint truffles. Those are really popular, flavors, I would say.
How do you create them? I mean, do you create flavors for specific holidays, or do you just based on what people like, or do you, you know, try new things?
Yeah, we do try new things. We have certain seasonals that we bring back every year, and people like them every year, because I'm always like, we should change this, but there are people who love them each time. So we do try to create new things now and then, and new truffle flavors. But we have a lot of people who only buy during certain times of year, so for them, it's got, like going back to your favorite restaurant and getting that dish. So we don't have to continually be changing chocolate flavors all the time. We all love to, though. And we're always kind of experimenting, thinking about flavors. And when we get a minute, we do that. And really, any time that a flavor for some reason stops selling well, then we say, okay, it's time to think about a new one. Let's rotate this out. And so we do some of that, but it doesn't happen nearly as often as you would think. You have a lot of people who have their favorites, and so the minute we take away something, we tried to take away honey lavender one time, and oh my gosh, it was like, I thought there'd be picket signs. It was like, what's going on? So so we brought it back, and so we have honey lavender, don't worry.
Now, how do you come up with the flavors? Because you have some interesting combinations. Tell me a little bit about some of the ones that people might think are a little bit unusual.
Honey lavender is one of them. Some of it we come up with. This is from a long time ago when I would kind of look for new flavors. And sometimes it often comes from looking at general culinary profiles. Everything from meats and sauces, and then salad dressings and preserves, marmalades, different flavor profiles and combinations. And then kind of fine-tuning it and saying, okay, how and where will that fit in with chocolate? Chocolate has a pretty broad range of what spices and flavors will fit with it. And, you know, everything from your spicy with dark chocolates and with, you know, for your spicy chocolate bar, your fiery pepper truffle. And then your sweet whites with that honey and that lavender mix well. So it really kind of opens up when you really broaden the types of chocolate and those flavors, and then kind of enter in different spices and sweetness and sour and bitter, and it just, yeah. So I look at kind of everything, and it's funny, yeah, people are like, meats and marmalades and like glazes, and like when balsamic comes into play, well, it fits in your chocolate profile too, and it, you know, so we used to do a strawberry balsamic. We keep talking about bringing that back. But we have the Cabernet Balsamic right now. And so it's kind of just a broad range and then kind of going from there. And sometimes things work really well, and sometimes it's just like, oh, that is not going to, that's not working.
And so, yeah. Are there some things that don't go, or that you tried and that just didn't work?
Yeah. I always have loved the tomato basil parmesan sort of combo, but I was like, I can do it in chocolate, and it didn't fly. Maybe some sort of certain combination. Now it's that tomato that I don't know. I need to figure out a different acidic, sweet something to pull in. I don't know. I need to think about a new method for that. But yeah, it didn't work when we tried that.
We've been talking with chocolatier Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town. Stay with us for more from Elizabeth here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town. The shop recently marked its 10th year in its Massachusetts Avenue location with an expansion and a grand reopening. Now, in addition to the lineup of chocolate truffles, toffees, and other creations, The Best Chocolate in Town is now a coffee shop as well, with expanded hours and even more tasty treats. But I wanted to hear how the business got started, so Elizabeth filled me in on the backstory of The Best Chocolate in Town, how it's changed, and what's still to come.
So, The Best Chocolate in Town, you know, you've hit 10 years in your location on Mass Ave, but that's not where the story started. So tell me a little bit about how you started the business and what you were doing then.
Okay, so I started in college my senior year as a little side gig to make extra cash for the holidays. So I did that for 3 Christmases, and I had then graduated and was like, I was working in a gallery and working, doing some catering, and selling to a lady in Nashville, Indiana, wholesale to her. And it started to pick up, and I thought, well, maybe I could do this full time. So I wrote up a business plan, and this was in 1998. And my parents were like, well, you might as well try it. And so I kind of went for it. Not kind of, I did. And so I opened my first space. My rent was $200 a month for about 200 square feet. Yeah. I feel really old right now, back in my day. And so it was this little in downtown Edinburgh, this little space where I, you know, made it all health department approved and just did it. And I was there for a year and then grew enough to expand. And then I moved that space to Franklin and acquired more square footage. And I was in Franklin for about 8 years, eight-ish to nine. And then in 2007, moved up to Mass Ave.
I think when you were in Franklin is when the media started finding you, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, I had some fun write-ups, and I was in, there's the Daily Journal in Johnson County, and the Star picked up on some stuff, and gosh, yeah, that's right. I had some people come and do photographs and stories, and I started to get to know some different people in the industry, and that's when I met Regina from Arbistro and Artigo, and... there are a lot of people who go back that far. It just isn't, when you start thinking about it, it's like, oh, yeah, way back when.
So how did you decide to go from Franklin to Mass Ave? And back then, this end of Mass Ave wasn't nearly as busy as it is now.
Right. Well, so my thought was, because I had really at the time built up, that's when I built my website. I was on register.com for all you folks who know what that is. And I used ecommerce.com for the shopping cart, and paid monthly. So I built all that, and, I don't do my own now cause I have problems, even though WordPress is supposed to be so great. But I can't, I don't know why. So I built all of it back then and had a web presence then, and mostly all wholesale. So we, like how we sell to retailers now, Tastings downtown has it, and Artigo carries product, and Cork and Cracker, and I'm going to leave people out, New Day, and all these people. Well, that was my main business before, and the gift basket industry was a lot bigger back then. This is pre-2008, all the bad blah, blah of the economy. And so my business was wholesale. So we were sustained back then just with that. So when I moved to the Avenue, I kind of did an analysis like, okay, I can go, I can get my foot in, find a spot, I could be closed basically, have no retail sales, but still selling all this other stuff from wholesale, right. So when I started here on the Avenue then, I was still already, I had other orders we were filling, and so the walk-in traffic was a lot less. And then over time, obviously the retail side has really taken over, and I don't have as many gift, 2008 with the whole economy crash, the gift basket industry just went kaput.
Well, that's interesting. I never thought about that being one of the industries affected by that, but yeah,
it was, a lot of the luxury stuff. And with September 11th, that was a huge thing for corporate, really changing their budget around, and they were instead of big corporate parties, especially that particular year, there were very few corporate parties, a lot of donations, less gifting. And then even after that, for a long time, for those that remember, a lot of there was not as much party scene going on, and so the corporate budgets were really cut for gifts and stuff. So
that's interesting that something like that, so you know, the big, you know, a national event, global event, you know, can affect the business of a chocolate shop in downtown Indianapolis.
Yeah, and it's all now, you know, kind of looking back and watching that and seeing that happen. And, you know, along the way, something would go away, but something else would pop up, and I was really lucky. And I, you know, have other retailers who use us for different things and different reasons now. And we still have where we supply other places and a lot of corporate business now, and a lot of that rebounded in different ways. But yeah, that whole gift basket industry was so big for a little while. And that really, there's still some of that, but at the time it was the big thing. And part of it's just chocolate industry and the shift in the industry from some of the big guys buying up smaller Ardent Scharfenberger they got purchased by Hershey. And like 2005 through 2007, you had a lot of buying up of Dagoba, the organic chocolate. A lot of these are being purchased and better quality being somewhat better quality being produced cheaper or having bigger budgets from big parent companies. So it pushed the rest of us, any handmade, into an artisan category. So you started hearing about artisan chocolatiers, and those were the rest of us who are like, I can't make pretty chocolate and good chocolate at that cheap of a wholesale price. And you could get something that at least looked pretty and maybe was okay for real cheap. So it changed what we were going to have to do. So we've all carved out our niche of, you know, and you find us all over the country, handmade, high quality, doing our own artisan style of what we do. And, you know, when we found that people like that, and so you get people who buy that, and we buy the other chocolate for other reasons at other times. But that kind of sustained us in figuring out what we needed to be to stay around. So
what was it like when you opened on Mass Ave? What was the feeling of the block? Because all of this construction that we're looking out the window now, it just wasn't there.
Our bistro was down on the end. There was the sidewalk with the, I think it was like a green paint line indicating where the cultural trail would go.
Where it was going to go, right?
Where it was going to go. So there was all that fun project to go through. And the building across from us now, Trailside, that was owned by Center Township, and it was just vacant and not functioning. So there wasn't nearly as much stuff around here. So I kind of got in while I could in a space that was affordable for me and let things build up around me.
And they did. So the people came. The cultural trail did come in. And now what's it like to be in business on Mass Ave?
It's great. And people are excited. And it's always busy. And there's been so much great growth all up and down the whole avenue. And some of it's just, you know, as things shift and change, figuring out how you fit into that model and how to just sustain, you know, doing the best that you can all the time and then making yourself relevant and fitting in, because it does things shift and change over time, and things become more interesting to people than other things, and some things feel old. And so, you know, what do you do to stay relevant? And so this is kind of our new thing of being able to say, hey, we've still got great chocolate, because that doesn't really change. It's like, if it's good, it's good. It doesn't just get bad unless you change something. And then adding in great desserts and the espresso and having seating now, and so updating ourselves a little bit and trying to just enjoy the growth around us now. We don't have to say, you know, over college, yeah, there's more stuff. Yeah, keep going. No, keep going. Another block. Yeah, we're down on the left.
So now, tell me a little bit again about the expansion that Best Chocolate in Town has seen recently.
The expansion in terms of...
Just around us?
So just tell me about how the shop has grown this past year.
Oh, okay. So this past year, we have grown by leaps and bounds. The holidays always kind of push us beyond our limits with the quantity that we can never quite achieve everything. So all the quantity that people want. So we finally hit that spot where over the past year we've changed up the space a little bit. We've grown to 3,100 square feet in another commercial kitchen. We've added the cafe seating. And really just pushed a little to achieve really things and thoughts and plans that have been in my head for quite some time.
So tell me what things that you think about. You know, tell me what you're going to be doing at the production facility and the baking that you're doing there, and you know what might be coming down the road.
So at the commercial kitchen off site from here is where we would make our cookie dough, and then we bring it over and we bake it here. So it's baked. We can bake fresh daily. We'll be making the brownies over at the other space. We have what's called the Pave Maria, which is a flourless chocolate cake that will make you sing Ave Maria. So there's that. And then we're going to have some specialty things. We're going to hopefully seasonally, we'll work with like Waterman's and get strawberries for strawberry pie. And, you know, we want to be real seasonal with some real special, unique things that will be limited. But we'll still have the pave. I've got a really great chocolate peanut butter tart that we're going to be making. We made that this summer, and I need to pull that back out and get it going. So we've got a lot of those kinds of things at that space. And most of the – it's hard to break up the production piece. Well, you boil caramel, you let it cool, then you have someone else who's cutting it and dipping it. So to have that under one roof is pretty essential. So that's, it was a struggle to decide to move most of that because you can't see as much. We're going to try to bring more dipping back, but you can't see as dipping. We're using the chocolate for mochas and hot chocolates and really wonderful stuff. But most of that production has to be at the other space under one roof.
So people in the past, they had seen you working over in a small area of the Mass Ave shop, mm-hmm. you know, so, but even though they might not be seeing you doing as much work there, you'll have more stuff in the shop, right?
Right. We'll have more stuff in the shop and they'll be able to see us baking and you'll smell the cookies. And there will be times where we'll be emergency cooking on the stove in the back and making caramel. And we'll probably still be dipping some at those machines every, well, hopefully not just during the holidays. We may try to bring some dipping back here, but yeah, a lot of it's at the other space, 3 minutes away.
So what do you see 2017 being as how it's 10 years in business here? You know, that's a landmark event for a small business. So what do you see this next year bringing?
More people hanging out since we've changed our hours. So we'll get the 8 a.m. and meeting crowd and do more of these. I hear our espresso machine in the background. It's so lovely hearing that. So, you know, more espresso, more drinks, more hanging out and just sitting in our space and enjoying the smells of the cookies, baking and things. Kind of just gain our footing. I can't reveal my next plan. Like we're not even finished. The artwork's not on the wall. And I'm like, okay, my next 5 years. And I was like, lay off the espresso, Elizabeth, calm down. So I do have some things kind of I'm thinking about that expand on all of our dessert line and cookie stuff. But I need to gain some self-control and just keep focused. We're open, we're running, people are going, things are fine. Keep going. So I've got little things I'm thinking about, but I'm going to give us this year at least to kind of, you know, make sure things are going well. There's always kinks and little fires to put out. So getting that kind of stuff pulled together and then, I don't know, and then you'll see.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Garber of the Best Chocolate in Town. You can find out more about the shop at bestchocolateintown.com or look for it on Facebook. The subject of food deserts is a major concern for those in the local food community. The fact that some of us simply do not have access to fresh food can be startling. And to realize that the problem hits those in rural communities just as it does for those who live in cities, well, that was a surprise for Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler. But his realization that there was hunger in the midst of his rural central Indiana community prompted him to do something about it. Last year, he put acreage on his own farm into production, growing fresh produce, with the thought that he could help address the hunger problem in Hancock County. After investing their personal finances into getting started, Jonathan and his wife Amanda formed Brandywine Creek Farms, and the project began to grow, in a big way. In fact, in its first season, the farm grew more than 200 tons of produce, more than 400,000 pounds. And this year, the goal is to grow even more. I talked with Jonathan, founder and executive director of Brandywine Creek Farms, about how the first season went and about his plans to do even more this year.
It came about from my son telling me that there was a classmate of his that was taking home food from the food pantry at his school. My son goes to Eastern Hancock, mm-hmm. which is...
So you're in a rural area.
Very rural. A lot of the trophies that you see displayed at Eastern Hancock, you know, have to do with agriculture.
FFA and
yeah.
things like that.
And they even have cattle there on campus. So
you're in the middle of a farming community.
Right. And I was just, you know, kind of taken aback. And I told him that he was probably mistaken. Mm-hmm. He was probably taking it home from the cafeteria for whatever reason. And he said, no, we have a food pantry. So I actually Googled it. And
did you to look it up?
Yeah, and they did. And then I talked to the principal. And, yeah, they have a full-functioning food pantry that serves about 46 families.
In a rural area in central Indiana.
Yeah, yeah. So I started looking at a couple of farms. I actually watched a documentary called A Place at the Table. It talked about food insecurity. And I remember there was a teacher that was working in a school that was passing out food. And she goes, you know, I would love to be taking them fresh fruits and vegetables, but that's not what we get donated. we get donated boxes of processed food. So I talked to my wife and, you know, we talked about maybe planting an acre or two for that pantry. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what if we turned all 36 acres at, you know, addressing the lack of produce? And she thought it was a great idea, and that's how we got started.
So the problem is that even in rural areas, there are food deserts, fresh food deserts, surrounded by corn and soybean fields.
Absolutely. They can actually be somewhat worse than the ones in the urban areas because, you know, an urban area considers that if you're not within a mile of a grocery store, you know, mm-hmm. you're in a food desert. Well, in the urban areas, it's 7 miles.
In the rural areas.
In the rural areas. Yeah, it's 7 miles. And if you don't have transportation in the rural areas, you're not going to get there.
There's no buses.
There's nothing, you know.
No cabs, no nothing.
I mean, in these small towns, there's Dollar Generals that have apples that I wouldn't give to my hogs, you know, for sale. You know, that's what they have there. And they're expensive.
Right. So you don't have very much of it, and it's expensive.
Right. So we got with cleaners, we got with some other people and talked about it, and we decided let's address this for Central Indiana.
Now, you weren't aware that this was an issue until your son kind of brought it to your attention?
I had no idea that. I was so ignorant to hunger and what hunger looked like. I was one of those guys that if I went to cleaners and seen overweight kids standing in line, I'd go, well, he's not hungry. He's not hungry. They're not hungry. You know, they're overweight. How can they be hungry? And when I heard a doctor speak on it at a TED Talks, and he actually said in the United States, our poor, our food insecure, have a shorter lifespan than that of people that are food insecure in third world countries because they develop disease, heart disease, diabetes. I listened to a local doctor here talk about she doesn't use the term adult onset diabetes anymore. She just calls it type 2 diabetes because it's affecting children. Yeah,
children and young people are affected by it.
Right.
So what was your reaction, you know, as a family to this sort of revelation that people are hungry and going without access to fresh produce right in your rural community?
Well, not everyone likes to talk about that, for one. It was surprising to us. I mean, it was very surprising to know that there were people that were my neighbors that were hungry. I mean, we have a soup kitchen, but again, that never seemed like to me. I mean, we looked at that like, well, maybe that's for the elderly that have trouble making their own meals and things like that. And it wasn't until, you know, we really looked at the rural aspect of it. And then within Central Indiana, within the city of Indianapolis, my idea of hunger was someone that was underneath a bridge in downtown Indy.
Right. And that's not the picture. That's not the whole picture, is it?
That's actually, you know, the least common type of hunger in Indiana anyway. More common is, where's my next meal going to come from?
The food insecure.
Right, right. So that's what we wanted to address.
So how did you go about doing that? So the idea was to start by raising some fresh produce for food pantries.
Correct. So, I mean, I just started my farm up again like we did every time, except we weren't planning on selling any of it. So we were, you know, that was a leap of faith. For me and my wife.
Now, how can you do that?
Well, we drained our personal savings doing that. But we had a couple of people come forward and say, hey, you know, you should really, you know, look at this from a nonprofit aspect. Here's a farm in New York that's doing what you guys do.
An example for you to look at.
Yeah, look at what they do. And I actually reached out and talked to them, and the guy was super awesome. It's called Matthew 25 Farm, and they're in upstate New York. And he talked to me for like 4 hours on the phone.
Oh, that's great.
And just told me everything that I need to think about and, you know, the volunteer aspect, you know, raising funds, who I should target to sponsor the farm. And then we had a lady in our community. She's actually a city council member. her name's Keely Buttram, that came forward and said, you know, if you guys are going to do a nonprofit, I've sat on a bunch of boards. I know how to do this, by all means. You know, I'd love to be your first board member. So, yeah, Keely became our first board member and has been instrumental in helping us grow that part of the business.
So did you have any experience in this sort of not-for-profit management at all? Tell me a little bit about your background.
No. Farming and transportation, trucking. So, yeah. So zero when it comes to that. So.
And you weren't daunted, you know, at the scope of the concept?
Daunted is not, you know, I would say disappointed after learning that the nonprofit side is very business driven. You know, it's not a bunch of, you know, we're doing this for the betterment of humanity. I mean, there are, that's the majority, but there are, you very much find the people that are like, this is a business.
Right. So, you know, so you found yourself in the midst of creating a not-for-profit, to address the problem. How'd that go?
Well, I mean, we still don't have our 501c3 status yet. I thought it was a matter of, you know, paying an attorney, filling out the paperwork, and the IRS gives you that. No, that's not the case. It can take 18 months. So
we did
that last summer, and we're hoping that our 501c3 status will, you know, our attorney's saying best case scenario, June.
But so. You went ahead and you had an awesome year last year.
Yeah, we raised 420,000 pounds of produce.
That's a lot of produce. Now tell me, how did that happen? How could you raise that much produce for the food pantries?
Well, I mean, we had a lot of great volunteers come out. All three of my sons easily put 70 hours of work in a week on the farm. I personally put that much work in on the farm. Our other board members stepped up, and they were, I mean, people that have no experience on the farm were out working on the farm.
You had some community days as well, right?
Yeah, we had a planting day where everyone came out and planted. What was great was we had a lot of grain farmers, their kids that came out and helped, not knowing anything about produce, and then realizing, wow, this is completely different. It's another animal. And they actually kept coming back and volunteering. So that was super awesome about that. Our hospital kind of heard about what we were doing.
In Greenfield,
mm-hmm. Hancock Regional. And we went to them and they said they'd like to sponsor our season because it's, you know, the health benefits of what we were offering were great. And they stepped up and sponsored us. And we actually found a fiscal agent that could take tax-exempt donations for us. And we were able to get in touch with some great people here in Indy and then some people outside of Indiana that stepped up and helped fund us.
So what did you raise? What kind of things did you grow last year?
So we grew tomatoes, sweet corn, green beans, actually not green beans, yellow wax beans, peppers, cucumbers, zucchini, and watermelons.
Now, were you guided by what the pantries wanted to receive, or
nope.
Did you just kinda...
I told the pantry I wasn't growing the things that they were wanting. They were wanting carrots and potatoes.
Okay.
You know, like hearty root crops.
Right.
And number one, potatoes, you know, an argument can be made that that's not exactly the healthiest thing somebody should be eating anyway. But what I did tell them was that I will give you this stuff that it'll have at least a week shelf life, if not more.
Okay.
You know, it's not like they're used to these donations of things getting ready to go bad.
Because they've traveled for one thing from California or Mexico, perhaps,
right.
And then gotten here and then gotten to the food pantries. So.
Right. So that was the easy part for us. We were able to explain to them, this is picked now. I mean, it's got a week before you got to get rid of it. So
sure.
If you pick it up on Friday, if you have it distributed by Monday, you're good. So gleaners really stepped up. I mean, we had a truck on call anytime we needed it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah. It was perfect. So
what was the reaction in the community? You know, did people buy into what you were doing?
I think a lot of people did, especially in Indianapolis. You know, there was other people that were just kind of, for a long time, I mean, we would have people stop by the farm and be like, well, you know, we see everything you're growing on Facebook. You know, we want, you know, a dozen ears of corn and, you know, how much is this? you know, well, we don't sell it.
Oh, you're right. Because that's not the model. Yeah. You're not raising it for a farm stand, right?
Right. We had restaurant. I mean, I had a produce broker, you know, come to the farm in a truck ready to make a large purchase. And I'm just like, we don't do that here. And he left a little bit, you know, frustrated. But yeah, we had a great response from people. I mean, we had everyone from you know, disabled Iraqi vets to you know, persons on house arrest that were allowed to come to the farm, you know, out, you know,
helping work the farm,
you know, and harvest. So it was great.
Now tell me again how much you raised.
We raised 420,000 pounds approximately. So
that's a lot of produce.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've been talking with Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms. Stay with us for more from Jonathan here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with Brandywine Creek Farms founder and executive director Jonathan Lawler about food deserts and about his efforts to help combat the problem. This year, Brandywine Creek Farms hopes to grow 1 million pounds of fresh produce for local food banks. It's been a challenging project, but one that has definitely engaged the community. Jonathan tells us about how the effort has brought together businesses, volunteers, and interns to help grow Brandywine Creek Farms, and about how the world is finding out about his efforts.
So last year was a successful year for Brandywine Creek Farms. Tell me what you have planned for 2017.
Well, we've doubled our acreage.
Now, how much acreage did you have?
We had 36 acres, but we only had 20 in production.
Okay.
The rest was, you know, old standing timber and stuff like that we wanted to keep natural. But I say doubled our acreage. We're going to have 46 acres into production. So
that's a lot.
That's quite a bit.
Now, compare that to what people might see on a typical farm. How many acres is that compared to what?
Well, like my father-in-law's farm is 6,000 acres.
Right.
But he grows grain and soybeans.
Right. Commodity crops.
The average, you know, the farms that you see at the farmers markets, those are typically anywhere from 1 acre to 5 or 7 acres. You go into southern Indiana where the wholesale growers are, we're going to be more in line with them.
With that size.
Yeah. So
now what are you planning right now? Are you figuring out what you're going to be planting this season?
Oh, yeah. So we're working with Flanner House, which the community center, we're mm-hmm. helping them with their urban farm, Flanner Farms. Besides that, we actually acquired 10 acres because I wanted to have the largest urban farm in the state of Indiana.
Okay.
We acquired 10 acres inside of the 465 loop.
Oh, my goodness. So 10 acres all in one place.
All in one place. So we're going to plant that as just a large urban farm. And then on top of that, we have acreage in Pendleton, and then we have our acreage in Greenfield.
And what's going to be growing?
So in the Pendleton, at the Pendleton property, which is right under 20 acres, we're growing nothing but sweet corn there.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and then in Greenfield, off-site, away from actual Brandywine Creek Farm site, we'll be growing roughly 6 acres of green beans and probably 8 acres of sweet corn there. And then the Brandywine Creek Farm site, since we don't use synthetic chemicals, we'll be planting tomatoes, watermelons, green peppers, and cucumbers and zucchini.
Now you said you aren't using synthetic pesticides and that sort of thing. What type of farm is it? What kind of farming are you doing?
Well, we're not a certified organic farm, but we try to live by organic principles. So
now, where will all this produce go?
A majority of it will be distributed through gleaners. You know, a small percentage of it goes to our own soup kitchens and food banks in Hancock County.
Well, that's what I wondered. Yeah. So you are still addressing that problem of food deserts right in your community.
Absolutely. The problem is with these smaller pantries, when you take them, you know, 4,000 pounds of zucchini,
right.
they're like, we'll take 2 boxes.
Right.
You know, that's all they can do. So
you have to keep their scale in mind.
Right. And that's easy for us. It keeps us in touch with our immediate community there. And then cleaners can handle, I mean, cleaners can take 30,000 pounds off the farm at a time, which is perfect for us.
Oh, my goodness. So how much do you intend to grow this year?
We're shooting for 1 million pounds.
1 million pounds of fresh produce.
Yeah. Yeah. 750,000 of which will be donated. And the rest we are going to sell in a wholesale fashion to help cover our costs.
So you are going to be raising money to keep the farm going.
Correct. Correct. We would like to. One of our backers is the Ruth Lilly Philanthropic Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to their leadership, they're excited because they feel like this is one of the first nonprofits they've worked with that can actually become self-sufficient.
Well, now that would be certainly a worthy goal.
Absolutely,
my goodness.
Absolutely. So.
Now, what have some of the challenges been as you've navigated this project?
Oh, well, volunteers.
Always, probably.
You know, sometimes fundraising is the worst part of this job.
Is it?
Oh, my gosh. I would rather, there is no job on the farm that is too awful that I'd take fundraising over that job. I mean, I would
You would work all day out on the farm.
I'd go out and pull stinging nettle before I had to go fundraise. But that's part of what we do, you know?
It is, right.
And the thing about us, you know, when somebody does donate a dollar to us, you know, a lot of people can quantify, you know, your dollar, you know, it cost us, you know, $1.50 to feed someone a meal. You know, with us, you know, it cost me, I think 3 cents is what I pay for a tomato plant.
Okay, so that dollar buys a lot of tomato plants.
Well, or it that dollar, when we put the fertilizer and everything in there, if that's 5 tomato plants that all produce 50 pounds of tomatoes apiece.
Wow.
You know.
So that's a big return on investment.
It's absolutely a huge return for people. So.
Well, I think if people see that,
right.
Then they become probably more willing to donate. So that then again is the challenge for you, is to tell that story.
Yeah, you know, letting people know. And the other thing is to just we have had some backlash as far as, you know, commodity farms saying, well, you know, we feed people too. I agree.
Of course,
yeah,
right.
Of course. My father-in-law is how I took, my grandfather was a produce farmer. My father-in-law was a commodity farmer. I've taken the best of both worlds and kind of put them together. You know, you come to our farm, we have tractors that are out working in the fields. We're not,
right.
You know, it's not a community garden.
It's a serious farm.
Yeah, absolutely. And we try to use the latest innovation. We try to be as sustainable as possible. We're really big on water conservation, you know, and limited. You know, we try to limit the amount of pesticides we use. Even though they're organic, they're still toxic to something.
Sure.
So we try to limit that as well.
So what are your hopes for this year? Do you have know, some things in mind?
That we meet our goal, that we're able to, you know, our goal is to be 10% of gleaners' produce donations.
Wow.
And that's where we got that 750,000-pound number. With the way we're changing things up, that's going to be an easier thing for us to hit this year. We have turned to mechanical harvesters for our green beans and our sweet corn, which will, instead of needing, you know, 20 or 30 people and begging for volunteers, it's one person
right.
on a tractor and one person driving the truck behind the harvester. So hopefully that will make a huge impact.
So how can people help? Are there, you know, you have a Facebook page and a website, right?
We have a Facebook page and our website's brandywinecreekfarms.org. You know, if they wanted to donate, if they want to come out and see the farm, see how they can help. You know, we have had, you know, the super interesting meeting that you actually moderated. I listened to them talk about, I asked the question about return on investment because they never saw any return on investment for what they were doing. And it amazes me the amount of sponsors that we've had that talk about the return on investment advertising with us.
Oh, well, that's very good then.
Yeah. You know, from a local tractor tire dealership, we called them. They knew who we were and what we did. are like, don't worry about the cost. We'll come out. We'll replace the tire on the tractor. Well, we took all kinds of pictures of them doing it, put it on Facebook. I mean, the guy called me back. He said, you call me if you have any more tire issues, because we've had three people now call, didn't even know that we did tractor tires. But they follow you guys on Facebook, and now they're having us go out to do their stuff.
Well, it must be very nice to be able to show that
to
potential donors.
And I think that might be part of the, you know, maybe there are nonprofits that don't really emphasize that. I mean, we're really big on if you're one of our sponsors, you are welcome to be at the farm. If you have material you want passed out, we will pass it out. If we have an opportunity to get you on local or national media, we'll do so. Our hospital was actually featured on a television show on country music television because of their sponsorship.
Now, you have had a lot of media attention about this.
We have. I've talked to people that, and you know, my wife hates it when I tell people this, but like I had, we're going to be featured in Taste of Home magazine for their May issue, their spring issue. And when they called and I talked to them first, I thought Taste of Home was like a magazine out of Zionsville, Indiana. I didn't know that it was a national magazine.
It's a massive readership Taste of Home.
I had no idea. And I told my wife, I was like, yeah, they want pictures and stuff and they want to do an interview. And I had actually told the lady, well, we can come to Zionsville if you want.
Right.
And she's like, and she just said, well, that's okay. You don't need to do that, because I don't think she knew what I was talking about either. And
did it work out?
Yeah, it worked out. So my wife took over that part of it.
We've been talking with Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms and his efforts to raise fresh produce for local food banks. For more information, you can find the farm on Facebook or go to brandywinecreekfarms.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town, and Jonathan Lawler, Executive Director of Brandywine Creek Farms. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.